The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 8, Side 1.
And so, asking forgiveness of my stricter readers for this new word, and it is not entirely new if a vacant spot was left for it in the language, I shall from now on make use of it from time to time. And that is what this chapter is about. The camp keepers, and the prison keepers with them. We could begin with the generals, and it would be a marvelous thing to do, but we don't have any material. It was quite impossible for us worms and slaves to learn about them, and to see them close up. And when we did see them, we were dazzled by the glitter of gold braid, and couldn't make anything out. So we really know nothing at all about the chiefs of Gulag who followed one another in turn, those tsars of the archipelago. But if we come across a photo of Berman, or a word or two of Apeter, we seize on it immediately. We know about those Garanin executions, but of Garanin himself we know nothing. All we do know is that he was not satisfied with simply signing. When he went around the camps, he was not loath to empty his mauser into whatever mug he took a dislike to. We have written about Kashketin, but we never saw that Kashketin face to face, thank God. We managed to collect a little material on Frenkel, but not on Zavenyagin. He, the recently deceased, escaped being buried with the henchmen of Yezhov and Beria, and the newspaper hacks wrote of him, the legendary builder of Norilsk. Did he lay bricks with his own hands? Realizing, however, that from up above Beria loved him dearly, and that from down below him the MVD man Zinoviev spoke highly of him, we suppose he was an out-and-out beast. Otherwise he would not have built Norilsk. As for Antonov, the chief of the Yenisei camp, we can be grateful that the engineer Poboji described him for us. And we would advise everyone to read this portrayal, the unloading of lighters on the Tats River. In the depths of the tundra, where the railroad has not yet extended, will it ever? Egyptian ants are dragging locomotives across the snow, and up above Antonov stands on a hill, watching over everything, and setting them a time limit for unloading. He flew in by air, and he is about to fly out by air immediately. His whole retinue dances around him. Napoleon had nothing like this. And his personal cook sets fresh tomatoes and cucumbers on a folding table right before him, in the midst of the Arctic permafrost. And the son of a bitch shares with no one, shoving the whole lot into his own belly. In this chapter we are going to cover those from Colonel down. We'll chat a little about the officers and then go on to the sergeants. Briefly cover the infantry guard, and that will be it. Let anyone who has noted more than we did write down more. Our limitation is this, when you are confined in prison or in camp, the personality of the prison keepers interests you only to the extent that it helps you evade their threats and exploit their weaknesses. As far as anything else is concerned, you couldn't care less. They are unworthy of your attention. You are suffering yourself, and those around you who are unjustly imprisoned are suffering, and in comparison with that sheaf of sufferings, which is too much for your outspread hands to encompass, what are these stupid people in their watchdog jobs to you? What are their petty interests to you, their worthless likes and dislikes, their successes and failures in the service? And then later, too late, you suddenly realize that you didn't observe them closely enough. Without even discussing the question of talent, can a person become a jailer in prison or camp if he is capable of the very least kind of useful activity? Let us ask, on the whole, can a camp keeper be a good human being? What system of moral selection does life arrange for them? The first selection takes place on assignment to the MVD armies, MVD schools, or MVD courses. Every man with the slightest speck of spiritual training, with a minimally circumspect conscience, or capacity to distinguish good from evil, is instinctively going to back out and use every available means to avoid joining this dark legion. But let us concede that he did not succeed in backing out. A second selection comes during training and the first service assignment, when the bosses themselves take a close look and eliminate all those who manifest laxity, kindness, instead of strong will and firmness, cruelty and mercilessness. And then a third selection takes place over a period of many years. All those who had not visualized where and into what they were getting themselves now come to understand and are horrified. To be constantly a weapon of violence, a constant participant in evil, not everyone can bring himself to this, and certainly not right off. You see, you are trampling on others' lives. And inside yourself, something tightens and bursts. You can't go on this way any longer. And although it is belated, men can still begin to fight their way out, report themselves ill, get disability certificates, accept lower pay, take off their shoulder boards, anything just to get out. Get out. Get out. Does that mean the rest of them have got used to it? Yes, the rest of them have got used to it, and their life already seems normal to them. And useful, too, of course. And even honorable. And some didn't have to get used to it. They'd been that way from the start. Thanks to this process of selection, one can conclude that the percentage of the merciless and cruel among the camp keepers is much higher than in a random sample of the population. And the longer, the more constantly, and the more notably a person serves in the organs, the more likely it becomes that he is a scoundrel. We do not lose sight of the lofty words of Dzerzhinsky. Whoever among you has become hardened, whose heart cannot respond sensitively and attentively to those who suffer imprisonment, get out of this institution. However, we cannot relate these words in any way to reality. Who was this meant for, and how seriously, considering that he defended Kosirev, Part 1, Chapter 8? And who paid any attention to it? Neither terror as a means of persuasion, nor arrests on the grounds of unreliability, nor the executions of hostages, nor those early concentration camps 15 years before Hitler, give us the slightest feeling of those sensitive hearts or those knights in shining armor. And if some did leave the organs themselves on their own in those years, then the ones Dzerzhinsky invited to stay could not help but grow hardened. And whoever became hardened or was hard to begin with stayed. And maybe a different kind of advice was given on another occasion, but we simply don't have the quotations. How adhesive are those fashionable expressions which we are inclined to take over and use without thinking or checking them? An old Czechist, who has not heard these words, drawled with emphasis as a mark of special esteem. If the Czechs wish to distinguish a camp keeper from those who are inexperienced, inclined to fuss, who shout pointlessly and do not have a bulldog grip, they say, "And the chief there is an old Czechist." Like that major who burned Klempner's sonata about shackles. The Czechists themselves were the ones who put this term into circulation, and we repeat it without thinking. An old Czechist. What that means at the least is that he was well regarded under Jagoda, Ježov, and Beria. He was useful to them all. But let us not digress and begin to talk about Czechists in general. There has already been one chapter in this book on Czechists in the specific sense. The Czechists of the security operations, interrogation, gendarme, persuasion. And the camp keepers merely like to call themselves Czechists, merely aspire to that title, or else have come here from those jobs for arrest because here their nerves are not subject to such wear and tear, and their health is not being undermined. Their work here does not require of them either that degree of development or that active pressure of evil demanded back there. In the Czech RGB, one must be sharp and quick and invariably hit the eye, but in the MVD, it is enough to be dull and not miss the whole skull. To our chagrin, we cannot undertake to explain why the slogan, "the proletarianization and the communization of camp personnel," which was successfully carried out, did not create in the archipelago that fluttering love of man, according to Dzerzhinsky. And by October 1923, the number of them in the RSFSR was already 12,000, and by January the 1st, 1925, 15,000. From the very earliest revolutionary years, in courses in the Central Penal Department and the Provincial Penal Departments, the junior administrative staff, in other words, the internal custodial staff, trained for prisons and camps without interrupting work, in other words, on the job, already in prisons and camps. By 1925, only 6% of the Tsarist prison custodial staff remained. What hardened old servitors! And even earlier, the middle-rank camp command staff had become fully Soviet in composition. They continued to study, first at the law faculties of the People's Commissariat of Education. Yes, the People's Commissariat of Education, and not faculties of lawlessness either, but of law. From 1931 on, these became the corrective labor divisions of the law institutes of the People's Commissariat of Justice in Moscow, Leningrad, Kazan, Saratov, and Irkutsk. The graduates were 70% workers in origin and 70% communists. In 1928, by decree of the Council of People's Commissars and the never-objecting VTSIK, the powers over the prison regimen of these proletarianized and communized chiefs of places of confinement was expanded still more. Just imagine, love of man somehow didn't happen. Many more millions of people suffered from them than from the fascists. And they weren't POWs either, nor conquered peoples, but their own compatriots on their own native soil. And who is going to explain that to us? We can't. Do a similarity of paths in life and a similarity of situations give rise to a similarity in characters? As a general thing, it doesn't. For people with strong minds and spirits of their own, it does not. They have their own solutions, their own special traits, and they can be very surprising. But among the camp keepers who have passed through a severe negative selection process, both in morality and mentality, the similarity is astonishing, and we can, in all likelihood, describe without difficulty their basic universal characteristics. Arrogance. The camp chief lives on a separate island, flimsily connected with the remote external power, and on this island he is without qualification the first. All the zeks are abjectly subordinate to him, and all the free employees too. He has the biggest star on his shoulder boards of any there. No limits are set to his power, and it admits to no mistakes. Every person complaining is always proven wrong, repressed. He has the best house on the island, the best means of transportation. The camp keepers immediately below him in rank are also raised extremely high. And since their whole preceding life has not given birth to any spark of critical capacity inside them, it is impossible for them to see themselves as other than a special race of born rulers. Out of the fact that no one is capable of resisting them, they draw the conclusion that they rule very wisely, that this is their talent, organizational. Every day, each ordinary event permits them visibly to observe their superiority. People rise before them, stand at attention, bow. At their summons, people do not just approach, but run up to them. On their orders, people do not simply leave, but run out. And if he, Dukelski of Bamlag, walks to the gates to watch the dirty rabble of his workers marching in a column surrounded by police dogs, he is the very image of a plantation owner in a snow-white summer suit. And if they, Unschlag, have taken it into their heads that they would like to ride out on horseback to inspect the work in the potato field, where women dressed in black are struggling and sinking into the mud up to their bellies, trying to dig potatoes, which incidentally were not removed in time and had to be ploughed under in the spring for fertilizer, then these camp keepers are dressed up in gleaming jackboots and in faultless woolen uniforms as they, elegant horsemen, ride past their drowning female slaves like the original Olympians. Stupidity always follows on the heels of smugness. Deified alive, each knows everything inside out, doesn't need to read or learn, and no one can tell him anything worth pausing over. Among the Sakhalin officials, Chekhov met clever, energetic men with scholarly leanings who had studied the locality and local life thoroughly, and who had, in fact, written geographical and ethnographical studies. But even for a laugh, it is impossible to imagine one such camp keeper in the whole archipelago. And if Kudlati, the chief of one of the Ustvim work parties, decided that the 100% fulfillment of state work norms was not 100% at all, and that instead what had to be fulfilled was his own daily norm, taken out of his head, and that otherwise he would put everyone on a penalty ration, there was no way to get him to change his mind. So, having fulfilled 100%, they all got penalty rations. In Kudlati's office there were whole piles of volumes of Lenin. He summoned V.G. Vlasov and unctuously informed him, "Lenin writes what attitude one must take toward parasites." He understood parasites to mean prisoners who had fulfilled the work norm by only 100%, and he understood by the term proletariat himself. These two things fitted into their heads simultaneously. Here is my estate, and I am a proletarian. But the old serf-owning gentry were incomparably better educated. Many of them had studied in St. Petersburg, and some of them even in Göttingen. From them, after all, came the Aksakovs, the Radishchevs, the Turgenevs. But no one ever emerged from our MVD men, and no one ever will. And the main thing was that the serf-owners either governed their estates themselves, or at least understood a tiny little part of their estate operation. But the presumptuous MVD officers, with all kinds of state benefits showered on them, just could not take on themselves the additional burden of business management. They were too lazy for that, and too stupid. And they wrapped their inane idleness in a fog of severity and secrecy. And as it turned out, the state was compelled to erect, alongside their whole gold-shoulder-boarded hierarchy, a second such hierarchy out of the trusts and combines. The state is by no means always directed from the summit, as history well understands. It is very often the middle layer that, by its inertia, has determined the non-development of the state. But a second such hierarchy didn't surprise anyone. What is there in our country, after all, which is not duplicated, beginning with the very power of the Soviets itself? Autocracy. Auto-tyranny. In this respect, the camp keepers were fully the equals of the very worst of the serf owners of the 18th and 19th centuries. Innumerable are the examples of senseless orders, the sole purpose of which was to demonstrate their power. And the farther into Siberia and the north they were, the truer this was. But even in Khimki, just outside Moscow, today it's in Moscow, Major Volkov noticed on May the 1st that the Zeks were not cheerful, and he issued orders. "Everyone must cheer up immediately. Anybody I see unhappy will go off to the punishment block." And to jolly up the engineers, he sent third-termer girl thieves to sing them obscene ditties. People will say this was not tyranny, but a political measure. So, all right. They brought a prisoner transport to that same camp. One of the newcomers, Ivanovsky, was presented as a dancer of the Bolshoi Theatre. "What? A performer?" Volkov raged. 20 days in the punishment block. Go by yourself and report to the chief of the penalty isolator." After some time had passed, he telephoned. "Is the performer there?" "He is." "Did he come on his own?" "He did." "Well then, let him out. I am appointing him assistant to the commandant." And that same Volkov, as we have already mentioned, ordered a woman's head shaved because she had beautiful hair. The surgeon, Fuster, a Spaniard, did not play up to the camp chief. "Send him to the stone quarry." They did. Soon afterward, the camp chief himself fell ill and needed an operation. There were other surgeons, and he could have gone to a central Moscow hospital, but no, he had faith only in Fuster. "Bring him back from the quarry. You are going to operate on me." But he died under the knife. And one camp chief made a real find. It turned out that a Zek geological engineer, Kudzak, possessed an operatic tenor voice. Before the revolution, he had studied in Petersburg with the Italian teacher, Repetto. And the camp chief also discovered that he himself had a voice. It was 1941 to 1942, and the war was going on somewhere. But the camp chief was well protected from military service by his exemption, and he took singing lessons from his serf. The latter was sickly and dying, and was making inquiries in an effort to locate his wife, while his wife, O.P. Kudzak, in exile, was trying to find her husband through Gulag. The search documents came together in the chief's hands, and he could have helped them re-establish communication. However, he did not do this. Why not? He reassured Kudzak that his wife had been exiled but was living well. Formerly a teacher, she worked first as a charwoman in the grain procurement's office and subsequently on a collective farm. And he continued to take his singing lessons. And when in 1943 Kudzak was at death's door, the camp chief spared him, helped to get him released because of illness, and let him go to his wife to die. So he was not really a vicious chief. A sense of possessing a patrimonial estate was typical of all camp chiefs. They perceived their camp not as a part of some state system, but as a patrimonial estate entrusted them indivisibly for as long as they occupied their positions. Hence came all the tyranny over lives, over personalities, and hence also came the bragging among themselves. The chief of one of the Kengir camps said, "I've got a professor working in the baths." But the chief of another camp, Captain Studnikov, put him down with, "And in my camp I've got an academician barracks orderly who carries out latrine barrels." Greed and money grubbing. Among the camp keepers this was the most widespread trait of all. Not everyone was stupid, and not everyone was a petty tyrant, but every last one was engaged in attempting to enrich himself from the free labor of the zecs and from state property, whether he was the chief in that camp or one of his aides. Neither I nor any one of my friends could recollect any disinterested camp keeper, nor have any of the zecs who have been corresponding with me ever named one. In their greed to grab as much as possible, none of their multitudinous legitimate monetary advantages and privileges could satisfy them. Neither high pay, with double and triple bonuses for work in the Arctic, in remote areas for dangerous work, nor prize money, provided management executives of camp by Article 79 of the Corrective Labor Code of 1933, that same code that did not hinder them from establishing a 12-hour workday without any Sundays for the prisoners, nor the exceptionally advantageous calculation of their seniority. In the north, where half the archipelago was located, 1 year of work counted as two, and the total required for military personnel to earn a pension was 20 years. Thus, an MVD officer on completing MVD school at age 22 could retire on a full pension and go to live at Sochi at 32. No. Yet every channel, meager or abundant, through which free services, food products, or objects could flow, was always used by every camp keeper graspingly and gulpingly. Even back on Solovki, the chiefs had begun to expropriate cooks, laundresses, stable boys, woodcutters from among the prisoners. And from then on there was never any end to, and from up above never any prohibition against, this profitable custom. So the camp keepers also took for themselves cattle herdsmen, gardeners, or teachers for their children. And in the years of the most strident outcry about equality and socialism, in 1933, for example, any free employee in Bumlag, for a minuscule payment to the camp cashier, could acquire a personal servant from among the prisoners. In Knyaz Pogost, Aunt Manya Utkina looked after the cow of the camp chief, and for this was rewarded with a glass of milk per day. And under the Gulag way of life, this was real generosity. And it would have been more likely in the Gulag way of life for that cow not to belong to the chief, but to be kept for improving the diet of the sick. But the milk would be kept on going to the chief. Not by the glass, either, but by the pailful and the bagful. Everyone who could possibly get fed off the rations of the prisoners did so on principle. Read over, dear reader, Lippi's letter in chapter 9 above, the outcry, one would gather, of a former storeroom clerk. After all, it was not out of hunger, not out of need, not out of poverty, that those Kuragins, those Pozvyshapkas, those Ignachenkos hauled out bags and barrels from the storeroom, but very simply thus. Why shouldn't they enrich themselves at the expense of the mute, defenseless, starving slaves? And all the more so during wartime, when everyone else around was grabbing. Anyway, if you didn't live that way, everyone would laugh at you. I am not even going to make a special issue here of their betrayal of trustees who used to catch it because of the shortages. And the Kolyma prisoners, remember, whoever was in a position to steal from the common food pot of the prisoners, the camp chief, the chief of regimen, the chief of the cultural and educational section, the free employees, the duty jailers, all invariably stole. And the gatehouse guards swiped sweetened tea at the gatehouse. Even just a spoonful of sugar, just so as to eat off the prisoners. What you take from a dying man is sweeter. The chiefs of the cultural and educational sections are best not recalled. They were a big laugh. They all swiped. But it was all small-scale stuff. They were not permitted anything bigger. The chief of the KVCH would summon the storeroom clerk and give him a bundle, a pair of tattered cotton padded breeches, wrapped up in a copy of Pravda. Take them and bring me some new ones. And the chief of the KVCH in 1945 to 1946 at the Kaluga Gates camp used to carry out of the compound a bundle of bits of firewood gathered for him by the Zeks on the construction project. And he went through Moscow on a bus, in a greatcoat, and with a bundle of bits of firewood. His wasn't such a sweet life either. It was not enough for the camp bosses that both they and their families were clothed and shod by the camp craftsmen, and once a special costume for a masquerade ball, a dove of peace was made for the fat wife of one camp chief in the camp workshops. It was not enough for them that they had their own furniture manufactured there, as well as all other kinds of household supplies. It was not enough that they even had their shotgun pellets cast there for poaching in the nearby game preserve. It was not enough for them that their pigs were fattened by the camp kitchen. It was too little. They were distinguished from the old serf owners because their power was not for a lifetime and not hereditary. And because of this difference, the serf owners did not have to steal from themselves, but the camp keepers had their heads occupied with one thing, how to steal something from their own enterprise. I am sparing with examples so as not to encumber the exposition. The sullen hunchback, Nevezhin, never left our camp at the Kaluga gates with empty hands, but used to walk out just like that in his long officer's greatcoat, carrying either a pail of linseed oil, or window panes, or putty, and all of it in quantities 1,000 times exceeding the needs of any single family. And a paunchy captain, the chief of Camp 15 on Kotelnicheski embankment, used to come each week in his passenger car for linseed oil and putty. In post-war Moscow, these were gold. And all this had previously been stolen for them from the construction zone and taken into the camp compound by those same Zeks who had received 10 years for a sheaf of straw or a packet of nails. But we Russians had long since been reformed and become accustomed to how things were in our motherland, and to us this only seemed funny. But here is how it was with the German POWs in the Rostov camp. At night the chief of camp sent them to steal construction materials for him. He and the other chiefs were building houses for themselves. What could these submissive Germans make out of all this, when they knew that this same camp chief had had them court-martialed for taking a pot of potatoes and sentenced to 10 or 25 years? The Germans figured it out. They went to the woman interpreter S and supplied her with a document justifying their act, a declaration that on a certain date they were going to be compelled to go and steal. And what they were building was railroad facilities, and because of the constant stealing of cement, these were being built almost entirely of sand. pay a visit nowadays to the home of the chief of the mine administration in Ekebastutz, D.M. Matveyev. He is now in the mine administration because of the curtailment of Gulag, but he was chief of the Ekebastutz camp from 1952 on. His home is filled with paintings, carvings, and other things made for him for free by the hands of natives. Lasciviousness. This was not true of each and every one of them, of course, and it was closely tied to individual physiology. But the situation of camp chief and the absoluteness of his rights allowed harem inclinations full sway. The chief of the Bure Polom camp, Grinberg, had each comely young woman brought to him immediately on arrival. And what other choice did she have except death? In Kuchmes, the camp chief, Podlesny, enjoyed night-time round-ups in the women's barracks, of the same sort we have already seen in Kovrino. He himself personally pulled the blankets off the women, allegedly searching for hidden men. In the presence of his beautiful wife, he simultaneously bedded three Zek mistresses. And one day, having shot one of them out of jealousy, he shot himself. Filimonov, the chief of the cultural and educational department of Old Mitlag, was removed for moral corruption and sent to be reformed, in the very same position, to Bamlag. There he continued his heavy drinking and fornication on a formidable scale, and he promoted his mistress from the non-political offenders to be the chief of the cultural and educational section. His son, incidentally, joined up with some bandits and very soon afterward was himself imprisoned for banditry. Malice, cruelty. There was no curb, either practical or moral, to restrain these traits. Unlimited power in the hands of limited people always leads to cruelty, and we cite here all the similarity in vices to those of the serf owners, not merely for eloquent argument. This similarity, alas, demonstrates that the nature of our compatriots has not changed in the slightest in 200 years. Give as much power as that, and there will be all the same vices. Tatiana Merkulova, a woman beast at the women's logging camp number 13 of Unschlag, rode on her horse among her female slaves like a savage plantation owner. Major Gromov, according to the recollections of Pronman, was actually ill on any day he had not imprisoned several prisoners in the punishment block. Captain Medvedev, camp number 3 of Ustvimlag, stood in the watchtower himself for several hours each day and jotted down the names of the men who had gone into the women's barracks in order to follow up by imprisoning them. He loved always to have a full isolator. If the cells of the isolator were not packed full, he felt something lacking in his life. In the evening, he loved to line up the Zeks and read them such statements as, "You have lost the game. There is never going to be any return to freedom for any of you, and don't dare to hope there will be." In that very same Ustvimlag, the chief of Camp Minakov, a former deputy chief of the Krasnodar prison, who had served 2 years for exceeding his power in that prison, and who had already been readmitted to the party, personally hauled from their bunks prisoners who refused to go out to work. Among them were thieves who began to put up a resistance, to brandish boards at him, and at that point he ordered all the window frames taken out of the barracks, at 13 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit, and then he ordered pailfuls of water to be poured in through them. All of them, including the natives, knew that the telegraph line stopped here. The plantation owners also developed anger with a twist, in other words, what is called sadism. A prisoner transport was lined up in front of Schulman, the chief of the special section of Bure Polom. He knew that this transport was going right out to general work. Nonetheless, he could not deny himself the satisfaction of asking, "Are there any engineers? Raise your hands." A dozen hands were raised above faces shining with hope. "Ah, so that's how it is. And maybe there are some academicians. Pencils will be brought you immediately." And they brought in crowbars. The chief of the Vilna colony, Lieutenant Karev, saw among the newcomers Junior Lieutenant Belsky, still in officer's boots and a tattered officer's uniform. Not long before, this person had been just such a Soviet officer as Karev, had worn just such shoulder boards. Did the sight of this tattered uniform arouse sympathy in Karev? Did he at least maintain an attitude of indifference? No, there was the desire to single him out for humiliation. And he ordered that Belsky, exactly as he was, without changing his uniform for camp clothing, be put to hauling manure to the vegetable garden. In that same colony, high-ranking executives of the Lithuanian Administration of Corrective Labor Camps came to the bath and lay down on the benches and gave orders they be washed, not just by prisoners, but by 58s only. Well, just look at their faces. After all, they are still going about among us today. They may well turn out to be next to us in a train, though not in anything less than a first-class compartment, or in a plane. They have a wreath in their lapel buttonhole, though what the wreath crowns it is impossible to say, and it is true enough their shoulder boards are no longer sky blue, they're shy, but the piping is blue, or even red, or maroon. An oaken cruelty is etched into their faces, and they always have a gloomy, dissatisfied expression. It would seem as if everything was going well in their lives, but there is that expression of dissatisfaction. Perhaps they have the feeling that they are missing out on something better, or perhaps God has marked them out infallibly for all their evil doings. On the Vologda, Archangel and Urals trains, in first-class compartments, the percentage of this kind of military is higher. Outside the window, shabby camp watchtowers loom. "Is that your establishment?" asks a neighbour. The military man nods his head affirmatively and says in a satisfied, even proud way, "Ours." "Is that where you are going?" "Yes." "And does your wife work there too?" "She gets 90, yes, and I get 250 myself." This means he's a major. "Two children. You'll not get far on that." Now this one here, for example, even has city manners and is a very pleasant person to talk to on the train. Collective farm fields have flashed past, and he explains, "In agriculture, things are going along much better. Nowadays, they sow whatever they want to." And when, for the first time, men clambered out of their caves to plant crops on a burned-over spot in the forest, did they not sow whatever they wanted to? In 1962, I travelled through Siberia on a train for the first time as a free man, and it just had to happen. In my compartment, there was a young MVD man, just graduated from the Tavda school, travelling under orders from the Irkutsk Administration of Corrective Labour Camps. I pretended to be a sympathetic idiot, and he told me how they went through probationary work in contemporary camps, and how impudent, feelingless, and hopeless the prisoners were. On his face there had not yet set in that constant, permanent cruelty, but he triumphantly showed me a photo of the third graduating class at Tavda, in which there were not only boys, but also veteran camp keepers finishing up their education, in training dogs, in criminal investigation, in camp management, and in Marxism-Leninism, more for the sake of their pensions than for the sake of service. And even though I had been around, nonetheless I exclaimed, "Their blackness of heart stands out on their faces. How adroitly they pick them out from all humanity." In a POW camp in Atme, in Estonia, there was an incident. A Russian nurse became intimate with a German POW, and they were found out. Not only did they evict her forthwith from their noble midst, oh no, for this woman who wore Russian officers' shoulder boards, they nailed together a plank booth with a tiny window near the gatehouse outside the camp compound. They spared no work and effort on this. They kept her in this booth for a week, and every free employee on his way to work and on his return would throw stones at the booth and shout, "You German whore!" and spit at her. That is how they are chosen. Let us help history preserve the names of the Kolyma camp keeper butchers who, at the end of the 30s, knew no limits to their power and inventive cruelty. Pavlov, Vizhnevetsky, Gakayev, Zhukov, Komarov, M. A. Kudryashev, Logovinenko, Merinov, Nikishov, Reznikov, Titov, Vasily, Durovoy. Let us also recall Svetlichny, the famous torturer of Norilsk, responsible for the loss of many Czech lives. Others, without our help, will tell about such monsters as Chechev, dismissed from the MVD in the Baltic states and sent to be chief of Steplag. Tarasenko, the chief of Usolag. Korotitsyn and Didorenko from Karkopolag. The fierce Barabonov, chief at the end of the war at Pechorlag. The chief of regiment at Pechzeldorlag Smirnov. Major Chepig, chief of regiment of Vorkutlag. Just a list of these famous names would take up dozens of pages. It is not for my lonely pen to pursue them all to the end. And they still have their former power. They have not yet set aside an office for me in which to gather all these materials, or offered me broadcast facilities for appeals over the all-union radio networks. One thing more about Mamulov, and that will suffice. This is that same Mamulov of the Kovrino camp, whose brother was the chief of Beria's secretariat. When our armies had liberated half of Germany, many of the MVD big shots rushed there, Mamulov among them. From there he sent back whole train loads of sealed cars to his own Kovrino station. The cars were shunted into the camp compound so that free railroad workers would not see what was in them, officially described as valuable factory equipment. And Mamulov's own Zeks unloaded them. No one cared whether they saw. Shoved in there, in bulk, was everything that crazed looters grab. Chandeliers ripped from ceilings, antique and ordinary furniture, table services wrapped up in wrinkled tablecloths, kitchen utensils, evening dresses and house dresses, women's and men's underwear and linens, dress coats, silk hats, and even canes. Here all this was sorted out, and whatever remained whole was carried off to apartments and distributed among friends. Mamulov also brought from Germany a whole parking lot full of confiscated automobiles. He even gave his son an Opel Kadett, the son being 12 years old, the age of a camp kid. For whole months long, the tailor and shoemaker shops in camp were piled high with loot, which had to be altered. Yes, and Mamulov had more than one apartment in Moscow, and more than one woman, too, whom he had to provide for. But his favorite apartment was in the suburbs at the camp. Sometimes Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria himself came here to visit. They brought out from Moscow a makeshift gypsy chorus, and even let two of the Zeks in on these orgies, the guitarist Fetisov and the dancer Malinin, formerly from the Red Army Ensemble for Song and Dance. And they were warned, "If you ever say a word anywhere, I'll see to it you rot." Here is the kind of person Mamulov was. They were returning from a fishing trip and dragged their boat through the vegetable garden of some old man, trampling all over it. The old man, it seems, began to protest. And how did they reward him? Mamulov beat him up with his own fists, to the point where the old man lay there, groaning into the ground. "It belongs to me, and for that they beat me," as the saying goes. When Beria fell in 1953, Mamulov was in bad trouble, but not for long, because after all he did belong to the ruling elite. He came out unscathed and became one of the chiefs of the Moscow Construction Trust. Then he got into trouble again for black marketing apartments, and once again he rose to the top. And by now it is ample time for him to be on a pension. But I feel that my tale is becoming monotonous. Does it seem that I am repeating myself? Or is it that we have already read about this here, there, and elsewhere? I hear objections. I hear objections. Yes, there were such individual facts, but for the most part under Beria. But why don't you give some of the bright examples? Just describe some of the good ones for us. Show us our dearly beloved fathers. But no, let those who saw them show them. I didn't see them. I have already deduced the generalized judgment that a camp keeper could not be a decent person. Either he had to change direction, or they got rid of him. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.